Let me just introduce Gail Olson, who is a farmer, an educator, and a community leader. Gail Hager, is it Hager?
Hager.
Mm-hmm. Hager. Thank mm-hmm. you. Olson is on the board of directors for the Practical Farmers of Iowa, PFI, a farmer-run organization which equips with innovative knowledge for farmers building resilient farms and communities. I just add that de Tocqueville, in 1830, when he visited America, he said one of the geniuses of America as a culture was that people created spontaneously their own organizations. And I think that Practical Farmers of Iowa is a perfect example of that. Olson and her husband, Jeff, grow organic, specialty, and traditional crops and beef cattle in Southeast Iowa. In 2014, they were awarded the Master Researcher status by PFI in recognition of their many research trials and field days. The Olsons believe in growing more than crops. A certified health education specialist, Gail Olson serves as assistant to the director for Iowa's Center for Agricultural Safety and Health. Throughout her career, Olson has encouraged and modeled citizen involvement. Her favorite accomplishments are those that bring youth and diverse audiences to the table to learn leadership, set goals, and implement strategies to strengthen their local communities. She teaches that healthy soil, healthy water, healthy people, healthy communities are interdependent. And making these connections is Gail Olson's passion. Mrs. Olson, please, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to start out with a little bit from the preambles to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, where it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." All men, and actually all white men. And next, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." Says we people, not the government or some subset of the government. They were sincere about we the people. They were still all white men. And initially, the proposal was that it would be we the people of the state of, and list the different 13 states that were all joining together to become this new nation. But there was a logistical problem in that the Constitution had to be ratified, and the people who were writing this didn't know for sure if the states would ratify it. So they were a little bit reticent about putting those names, all the name of every state listed there. So they decided to go back to we the people. They kind of had an ulterior motive too, because that was really where they made the transition from a group of states to an actual United States. And so having the Articles of Confederation be replaced by a single constitution, they decided that we, the people of the United States, was the best way of formulating that. And I would just like to add that I am so thankful that since that time, we have included with people, not only the white men, but we've also included the women and people of color, and really broadened that definition there. that wasn't the only tension that there was at the beginning. Agriculture has always been sort of a contentious area. Right from the beginning, there were two, and this is one of the things that was written up on the Visioning a Better America website, is that there was the tension between the Jeffersonians, who really envisioned a nation of independent farmers and craftsmen with a small centralized government that was mainly for defense and the things that that the individual states couldn't do for themselves. And then there was Alexander Hamilton, who envisioned an industrial America with factories and banks and a great big central, strong central government that could do a lot more with national development. And both of those were more than happy to kick the Native Americans out of their territory, actually long before they came. The Native Americans who had been doing such a good job of taking care of this environment that they were given, managing it in a completely different way that didn't include the concepts of ownership that the white colonists brought with them. And so right from the beginning in the United States, we had several different kinds of conflicts that were rearing their head through agriculture. Still happens. There's a new book coming out just today. It's going to be released, written by a woman named Beth Hoffman. She lives in Iowa now. She used to live in California. The book is called Betting the Farm, and I want to read just a little excerpt from it. There are two dominant storylines, ones that I call the agrarian tale and the bigger is better narrative. They've not only confused the public about the realities of farming, they have also, in effect, trapped farmers in a limited understanding of their purpose, of the importance of their own economic viability, and of their relationship with larger corporations and with one another. Ultimately, these myths distort the truth about agriculture in this country, making it hard to create something new, hard to promise again. Reliable and resilient, environmentally sound, and economically viable. So Linda, for today, to use Beth's words, is I hope to lift some of your confusion. Sometimes by talking through those is a good way for me to lift some of my own confusion too about some of the realities of farming. We'll talk today about some of the key factors in production and how those can help or hinder our vision. As I was trying to put this together, there's so many different topics that I could cover that I hope when we get to the end, we'll have a chance to have more of a discussion and a conversation about that. And also, Richard, I've kind of been working on a resource list. If there's a way that we can share that with people down the road, I think that would maybe be helpful.
Yes.
One of my favorite sayings is that none of us is as smart as all of us. And I think the founders must have felt that way at least somewhat too, because some of the systems that they built, the mechanisms that they built into our government are certainly ones where they forced debate and compromise and disagreements. I think they expected that when people did that, when people came to that table, they needed to be well-read, they needed to be educated, they needed to know what they were talking about so that they could have those healthy debates and then put together choices where they could pull out the best options. Another one of my favorite sayings is if we all agreed on everything, only one of us would be necessary. So I really do think that pulling out, everyone has a different perspective, everyone has a different knowledge base, everyone has a different set of experiences. And if we can figure out how to truly listen and come in a way to build something instead of looking at ways to tear things down, I think that really does give us stronger solutions. So my vision for a better America includes farms, people, and communities that are resilient and that can provide strong and stable flow of both food and fiber. I want soil that's healthy, water and air that's clean, farms and rural businesses that are economically profitable. That's not enough, though. I want to live in a rural community that's filled with people of all ages who value curiosity and learning, who understand the elegance of science, but also enjoy the beauty of the arts, where we can recognize the importance and wonder of the environment and learn how to steward it to the best of our ability, and where we never forget the importance of our relationships and taking good care of our people. I want real people to have access to the top quality health, education, and transportation systems that people in the cities have access to. I want to live in an area that values its diversity in different kinds of systems of farming, different kinds of people, varying perspectives, different types of wildlife, and even changing weather. That's part of what I like about Iowa, including the winters, believe it or not. And I want to repeat to the organizations that have really done a great deal to help me shape this vision are Practical Farmers of Iowa, PFI, and then also Iowa Center for Agricultural Safety and Health. I think they both value the livelihoods of farm families. ICASH, Iowa Center for Ag Safety and Health, does everything we can to try to keep farmers safe. And Practical Farmers of Iowa has a strong emphasis on on-farm research, on farmers leading that research, and welcoming everybody to their big tent of agriculture. I'd like to look back at history a little bit. We've made a lot of changes in the last 200 plus years of agriculture in the United States, but we're in the middle of some other major shifts that are occurring right around us and will continue, I think, for the next couple of decades. A lot of these changes are resulting in more consolidation and less diversity, which is not something that's going to help us keep working towards that vision, I don't believe. So one of my questions is, how can we make those changes be positive ones rather than negative ones? And I think, first of all, we have to know what it is that we're facing, be able to define it pretty well. Secondly, since we're a nation made up of states, we need a clear vision for our future and how those all fit together. One that accounts for diversity and not the diametrically opposed ones where we pit the industrial version of agriculture against the little guy, if you want to call them that. And I think third, we need to look at the science and then have those debates, have those talks about how does that fit in with what we want? How can we make it do what we want it to do? I think the policy and practice decisions that we make in the near future will have far-reaching impacts, not just on rural communities and farming, but on our whole food systems, much as Sabine talked about. We need to do a better job of protecting our people and our planets. And I looked at a lot of different ways that we could do this. And I think one of the ways is to look at the different factors of production, not just in agriculture, but production in general, and use that as our lens. So I want to look at access to land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. So first, looking at access to land, there's several different aspects that I think we need to consider. First of all is who owns and controls it. Over the years, ownership has shifted away from younger farmers and towards older farmers. That means that there's likely to be a big shift in ownership in the next couple of decades towards those as people who are 65 and above. And I've got a couple slides here. Let me see if I can get that up. There we go. Right. Are you seeing it now?
I don't see it, no. Chiwaya, could you release Gail's screen?
Here. Yes, you did. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There it is. See it now, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we'll go to the next one.
Beautiful photograph.
So this is kind of a busy slide, but you can see the trends just at a glance that those who are under 25 over the years hardly own any land at all. And as we get towards those that are 65 and older, and keep in mind, this was done the last year that's in here is 2012. So we're already going on 10 years past these 65 and older people are now 75 and older. So that land is going to be turning over here pretty shortly. Who will be getting it? Will it be people purchasing it for an investment? Will it be inherited by the people, by the sons and daughters of the people who are 60 or 75 and older? How will that land transfer happen? It's happening different ways than it used to. Land has held its value a lot better than a lot of other investments. And so there are people who never would have thought of investing their money in land who are buying land because it makes a lot more money for them than it does to invest it in a CD, for example. Auctioning is kind of a traditional way in agriculture. I know we've got with online auctions anymore, it really opens the can of worms as far as who can be present at an auction and bid on something. And I know of at least one situation where a piece of land wasn't bringing what the auctioneer thought he should be bringing. And so he called in a couple of his friends from far away that he thought might be willing to drop some money on it. And instead of the local people who were attending the auction being able to purchase it, all of a sudden they got outbid by somebody from a couple of counties over. So there's whole different ways of changing ownership of land these days. How do farmers access the land then? How do young farmers get involved? And I'll talk a little bit later about how difficult that is for them because of cost and just connections that they might have. Another important thing is how yield and how fertility and land use has changed. This is a slide that I was talking about as far as the change in price over time. So here we see for excellent land down to fair land, it's very close to $1 million to buy an 80 acre patch of high quality land. And there's not too many young beginning farmers who can afford that sort of a thing. And as far as the use of the land, I want to read to you again, and I'll go back, I'll stop sharing my screen here for a second. There's a book that was written by a gentleman named John Newell. It's called A Glimpse of Iowa in 1846. It was actually a book that part of the purpose in writing it was to help recruit people to come to this new area of the country. And so probably there's some exaggerating that went on in it. But I want to read you a couple of excerpts just to give an idea of what was a glimpse of Iowa in 1846. That was the year Iowa became a state, by the way. Undoubtedly, one of the most captivating features in the landscape scenery of a great portion of the Upper Midwest Valley is the unique and beautifully diversified prairies or unwooded tracts. They are, in fact, the gardens of nature, and who that has been an eyewitness can ever forget the impressions made upon his feelings when for the first time he gazed with rapturous delight upon the boundless prairie. The characteristic peculiarity of the prairie is the absence of timber. Although probably nearly three-fourths of the territory is without trees, yet so happily and conveniently are the waters and timber arranged throughout that nature appears to have made an effort to arrange them in the most desirable manner possible. The soil of the prairies of Iowa, and particularly the alluvial bottoms, is extremely rich and fertile. It is a black vegetable mold, sometimes intermixed with a sandy loam, easily cultivated and stands a drought remarkably well. The soil on the upland prairies will average from 18 to 24 inches deep, and on the rich bottom, lands from 30 to 48 inches deep. That's the depth of the topsoil. The surface is nearly black, but becomes lighter in descending until it imperceptibly mingles into a bed or underlayer of reddish clay, sometimes mixed with gravel or sand, sufficiently compact to preserve moisture and capable of being converted into excellent soil. Good water is usually obtained in the upland prairie from 20 to 30 feet below the surface. Like I said, he probably was exaggerating that, but on the other hand, there was certainly some truth to it. The Iowa Association of Naturalists has estimated the depth of the topsoil at that point in time to be probably closer to 16 inches, which is still significant. By 2000, the year 2000, the average was only 6 to 8 inches. If nothing is done to stop erosion, they said, the rest of Iowa's topsoil could be gone in the next 100 to 150 years. And let me show you part of why that's the case. This is what prairie roots look like. This little red arrow over here on this side is pointing at what Kentucky bluegrass looks like. So these are the roots that were in the prairie that were holding that 14 to 16 to 24 inches of topsoil in place. I was one of the most changed states in the nation, the most manipulated states. Back in Newell's day, what grows in this soil? All the grains, fruits, and plants of the temperate regions of the earth. They grow luxuriantly in Iowa. The production consists of corn, wheat, rye, oats, buckwheat, potatoes, turnips, beans, melons, all kinds of garden vegetables. Clover, timothy, and every description of tame grass grows luxuriantly and plays and well repays the labor of husbandry. Also goes on to talk about crab apples, wild plums, berries, strawberries, all kinds of diversity that was growing in that prairie. Now, come to today in Iowa. Saw an exercise that said, if you take one of those big DOT maps that, you know, covers the whole table in front of you, rip off 2/3 of that, and that's what in Iowa would be devoted to corn and soybeans, only corn and soybeans. Corn and soybeans that get planted in late April and May and get harvested in October. So from November clear until the next April, there's nothing growing in that ground. that's part of why it washes away. It blows away because there aren't any roots in the ground through the rest of the year to hold it in place. We can do something about that though. And those are some of the things that Sabine made reference to. What are some of those solutions? Planting plants so that there's roots that hold it back again. There is some research on prairie strips. You can see the difference in root systems here with all corn that's growing on the left-hand side of the screen. And on the right-hand side, it's mostly corn, but 10% is in prairie strips, just a strip of prairie plants. And with that 10%, there's 95% less soil that washes off. There's 89% less phosphorus and 84% less nitrogen that goes into the streams and prevents those problems that Sabine was talking about. 10% prairie planted. If you look at Iowa, you look at that same big map and you take out, instead of the 2/3 that goes in corn and soybean production, you take out a piece the size of a credit card, and then you cut that up in 100 little pieces and you throw it out over the whole rest of the state. That's what we have in native prairie left in the state of Iowa, just little bits and pieces here and there, maybe at the edge of a cemetery or around an old homestead or wherever. And most of them are not big enough that they can actually sustain the life of a prairie that would have happened in that area. So we don't get the benefit of that. another possible solution is cover crops. That's something that PFI has done a lot of research on, a lot of farmer-led research. What are cover crops? Cover crop is something that is planted before the money crop is harvested. So before you harvest your beans or before you harvest your corn or whatever it is you're growing, it works in gardens too, you plant a cover crop that covers all the dirt that's there. Sometimes it's cereal rye, it could be radishes, different kinds of legumes, turnips. It's planted while the crop is still growing. When the crop is harvested and starts putting down its roots before the crop that's growing is harvested, depending on what the cover crop is, it may start growing right away after the main crop is harvested, or it may just work on its roots through the wintertime. And when it warms up in the spring again, it grows up and everything turns green, sometimes as early as February. Those roots keep the dirt in place. They don't, we have something we call snert here in Iowa. It's a combination of snow and dirt that comes when the wind blows across the prairie and erodes the dirt into the snow. So if you have a cover crop, that really cuts down on the wind erosion. And then when the spring rains come, it cuts down on the flooding that happens too. It can be grazed for livestock in the spring. It can be turned under for green manure to help the next crop grow. There's a lot of different things that a lot of different uses for cover crops. And actually, there's a slide that talks about that too. The other thing it does is there's some research showing that it actually regenerates some of the, enhances the soil structure and regenerates some of that soil. It increases the soil organic matter that's in the soil. That can also help to act as a carbon sink. A lot of that depends on what kind of cover crop you're using, what kind of soils you have, what kind of crop you are growing, lots of different things. But it can make a big difference. It helps with the environmental quality. There's some demonstrations of the water that runs across a field that's had cover crops. And again, it cuts back on all of the nitrogen and phosphorus and just dirt that get washed away. And it can also improve pest management by breaking the life cycle of some of the insects that could damage your crop. The second area I want to talk about is labor. That's another thing that's changed, and another place the tension started in the United States. A lot of the labor initially were in our southern plantations with the slaves and some of the indentured servants that came over from Europe. Labor is still an issue. Getting young people involved is one of the ways that we can try to add into that. Immigration is still a big issue with labor on the farm. again, it looks very different in the small family farm versus the industrial model. Whether you have lots of employees or whether you have primarily family labor that works, and how that system all works together looks very different depending on which one of those you use. Sometimes there's seasonal help. A couple of important things to recognize, though, is that the average age of farmers in the United States is 57.5. That's not very young. and we talk a lot about beginning farmers, and often we think about beginning farmers as being somebody from FFA or fresh out of college. Actually, the average age of beginning farmers in the United States is 46.3. A lot of them are mid-career changes that they've decided they wanted to get into agriculture after they retired from the military or had a different career some other place. The youth are coming from a whole different system. You can see the FFA numbers are increasing, and there's all these different items that are in their curricula that they didn't have before. Here's some more information about the cost of farming. We talked about the land a little bit earlier. To purchase some of the capital assets, we're moving on to the third one now, up to $900,000 for machinery. Up to $322,000 or more for seed, fertilizer, and chemicals. You can see what those are. Again, 1.5 to 2.6 million. These are based on an estimate that Fast Company and Farm Journal, I think it was Successful Farming, did together. That doesn't even include the living expenses until their first income or the education expenses. this is a really busy slide, but the point of it is that a lot of the industry that supports agriculture is consolidated. This is all these little dots. The blue ones are seed companies. The bigger orange ones are, they call them a chemical company, although most of them also own the seed companies. And the green ones are others. But since this slide's been put together in 2018, Bayer has bought out BASF here. So that's become even bigger. This one is now the fourth one. This is a French company. So you have Bayer, which is a German company, one French company, one American company, and one Chinese company who control over 60% of the seed in the world. So our options are getting smaller and smaller. Our locus of control is getting further and further away from the local farmer. And they have rules about how much you have to pay for the technology, and that universities can't do studies unless it's a proprietary study, and farmers can't grow their own seed corn or seed beans to reuse that technology because of all of the technology that they've got, the intellectual property that's in there. Doesn't look that much different when you look at the food industry consolidation. There are basically 10 different companies that own the majority of brands that we see in our grocery stores. So again, consolidation and the lack of local control is really, really huge. So my time is running out here. The whole issue of consolidation relates to lots of big public policy issues. Things like antitrust laws, how big is too big? Campaign contributions, industry regulations. And as Sabine mentioned, a lot of those supply chain interruptions showed up big time during the pandemic. People were able to find some ways around those though, and that was really good. But I think some of the policy solutions that we need to consider, one of them is the right to repair, so that machinery that farmers have, the manufacturers would like to keep, again, their intellectual property away from everyone and only have their authorized dealers be able to do the repairs. Farmers are pretty handy. They know how to fix things, and they would like to save a lot of money by fixing their own things. So that's an important policy that is in process right now. The high-tech seed comes with expensive price tags. Farmers, they have to sign licensing agreements in order to be able to grow it. The same is true with contract livestock. In fact, our hog industry in the United States, very large portion of it is owned by China, including the farmland that the hogs are raised on, all the way up through the slaughter and processing of the meat. In many cases, the contract growers don't have any control over what's in the feed that they feed them. In fact, a couple of years ago, we had a situation where some of the feed had an additive in it that caused several deaths. And it took a long time to even figure out what that could be, because the people who were feeding the feed had no idea what was actually in the feed. They were just following their contract and feeding the feed that was provided to them. The Young Farmers Organization, this is one of the things I'll put in that resource list. They have a really good tool to be able to explore some of the ag public policy. You can select the level at the national level, at a state level, which state, or at the local level, whether it's a specific issue that you're interested in, and then their database will give you a listing of some of the policies that are out there, which gives you an interesting way to be able to look at some of the innovations that different states are. So that's something that I'll put in that resource list. The fourth factor is entrepreneurship, and that's where so many of our solutions come from. With PFI, we spend so much time working on on-farm research, designing the trials, doing it in a way that they're replicated and randomized. We do lots and lots with farmer-to-farmer networking and sharing, field days, webinars, special interest groups on all kinds of different things. I think we need to reconsider what kinds of crops we're growing, looking more at growing food instead of just commodities. And I think what Sabine had mentioned about what are the things that can grow well in an urban environment or the peri-urban environment or the rural environment, again, that's not something that's been a conscious decision as a system before. It's just been who wants to do what or who has access to do what. Working more on local foods through CSAs, through school to farm, farm to school, food hubs that can consolidate some of those kinds of things. Reconfiguring some of the supply lines, I think, is really important. One of the examples of that is that when COVID came through and so many farmers' markets were shut down, a lot of the growers came together, and the person who sold eggs got together with the person who had lettuce, and they got together with the person who had whatever, and they put together one website where people could order online, and many of them then packed the boxes and had a delivery point where no one had to come in contact with anybody else, just put it in the customer's trunks. The payments were all handled online. There were a lot of innovations that went on at that point in time, and a lot of ideas that were shared with people. I think one of the most important things is how we invest in people. Mentoring programs, leadership training, cross-training, relationship building, ways that we can do things to help build relationships and build knowledge and share knowledge between different people. I think here's a slide that shows a little bit about some of the different types of direct-to-consumer opportunities that we've already discussed. But in general, I think we can't wait for other people in the chain to figure out and take care of us. I think we're back to that we the people, where we need to learn how to advocate. We need to learn how to talk about ideas. We need to learn how to disagree with each other and negotiate, how to recognize the components of our work as farmers that benefit the public good, and to continue to be curious about how to do better for our people and our planet. And again, there's so many more things that I could cover, so I'll be more than happy to answer questions.